Wednesday, April 17, 2019, the time is 8:30, and this is the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the State of Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners. Roll call, please, Ms. Pope.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Donaldson?
Present.
Dr. Brundage?
Present.
Dr. Flowers?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Next is the approval of minutes. Is there a motion to approve the February 20th, 2019 regular session minutes?
I so moved.
I second.
Is there any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, I'll call for the vote. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to ARS 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration in action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. Upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any of the items on the agenda pursuant to ARS 32-431.03A2 to review confidential records, or A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on the parties present and request to speak. A person or representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and who is present may make a brief statement to the committee by filling out a request to speak form and giving it to the board staff person. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please use your initials, only initials, for patients and children. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in public meetings. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. I've been asked to move complaint number 1835 to the front. It's Sarah Hill, PhD. And that's the first complaint that I'm doing. I'm the lead member on this one. I think a little background is important in reviewing this case. Dr. Hill provides services to this particular patient in question. SA is a licensed psychiatrist. SA, Dr. Hill, and two other professionals rented office space in the same building. All the professionals working in the building referred patients to each other for services. The complaint is as follows. SA states that this particular patient started treatment in 2013 and that from 2013 to 2017, the patient received services 8 times. SA declares that the patient was non-compliant with recommendations, including follow-up visits after medication was prescribed. SA confirms that in October 2017, the patient contacted his office requesting an appointment. At the time of the request, patient claimed that she was last seen approximately 3 months prior. SA confirms that the patient was last seen April 2016 and her file was inactive in his electronic medical record. SA declares that Dr. Hill's unprofessional conduct began in October 2017 during the time the patient's request was seen for an appointment. SA explained Dr. Hill's unprofessional conduct as follows. Dr. Hill would yell at him in the hallway of the shared office space. Dr. Hill would pester him, stating that the patient needed a prescription. Dr. Hill would make demeaning remarks to him, such as, I was just like EA, and said, you fire patients. Dr. Hill continued to call and email him requesting that he see the patient and prescribe medications. SA claims that due to the large volume of phone calls, he had to block Dr. Hill's phone number. SA claims that when the incidents occurred between him and Dr. Hill, there were never any witnesses present. SA emphasizes that prescribing medication to the patient would be disregarding the Medical Practice Act current standards of care. SA affirms that he acquiesced and scheduled an appointment for the patient. SA describes the appointment with the patient as follows. Patient continues to say that she just needs a prescription for 300 milligrams of Wellbutrin. SA declares that he was apprehensive with prescribing the patient the requested medication due to some of the comments patient made during the appointment. SA confirms that he ultimately prescribed the medication, reviewed the patient's file, and sent a letter via certified and regular mail terminating patient from his care. SA declares that due to Dr. Hill's disturbing behavior, he discontinued working at the office on the days that Dr. Hill would be in the office. He stated that working at the office with Dr. Hill present gave him such anxiety that he submitted his 6-month resignation. He claims that part of his fear was that Dr. Hill indicated that she had carried a taser. SA declares that Dr. Hill is manipulative, dishonest, blameful of others, nonconforming to social norms, lacking remorse, and being irresponsible. That these behaviors are found on psychopathy checklist from Herbie Cleckley to Robert Hare, and including other adult psychopathy checklists is found in the Handbook of Psychopathy, second edition, edited by Christopher J. Patrick, is fondly disturbing. Dr. Hill responded in a timely manner via her attorney, Farron Akins. Dr. Hill provides information regarding her professional qualifications as follows. Dr. Hill received her license to practice psychology in Arizona in 1989. Dr. Hill was employed by schools for approximately 1.5 years. She worked at the Durango Jail in the psychiatric unit for approximately 8 years. During her time working at the jail, she began a private practice. Eventually, Dr. Hill provided services solely for her private practice, Scottsdale Psychological Associates. She practiced there for approximately 19 years and was part owner. In 2011, Dr. Hill relocated to the Tucson area where she rented office space to provide psychological services. In addition to renting office space, Dr. Hill contracts with Pima County Superior Court. Her contract is to conduct competency evaluations for the court. Dr. Hill addresses the complaint as follows. Dr. Hill confirms that she shared office space with SA. She explained that there were four professionals practicing in the office, 3 psychologists and 1 psychiatrist, SA. Dr. Hill states that her relationship with other professionals was strictly on a professional basis. Additionally, she confirms that she and SA often shared patients. Dr. Hill affirms that she recalls a time in which SA is referring to because SA's behavior was not normal. She declares that SA seemed agitated and contentious. Dr. Hill confirms that she and SA had a conversation regarding patient, but denies the allegation that she yelled at SA. She states that her intent was in no way meant to upset SA. Additionally, Dr. Hill claims that the office space is small and in the area in which SA claims the altercation happened was directly outside of the other 2 offices. Dr. Hill confirms that she has never yelled at associates or co-workers. Dr. Hill denies the allegation that she said anything to SA regarding EA. Dr. Hill claims that she does not even know EA. Dr. Hill affirms that she had 1 phone conversation with SA regarding patient, but that she never yelled, harassed, or badgered SA. She claims that she was unaware that SA blocked her phone number because she has not called him since that phone conversation. Dr. Hill alleges that her private practice is small and does not recall ever seeing SA after this incident. Dr. Hill was not aware of SA's reason for resigning, and in no way did she think it was because SA feared her. Dr. Hill declares that she never owned a taser. Dr. Hill denies allegations that she is manipulative, dishonest, blameful of others, nonconforming to social norms, lacking remorse, and irresponsible. Dr. Hill addresses her compliance with statutes and rules and ethical codes as follows. She declares that ARS 12-2294C12 authorized her to discuss patients with SA. Dr. Hill denies exploiting SA. Additionally, she points out that SA was an independent contractor, and ARS 32-6116Y refers to a client, patient, student, or supervisee. Dr. Hill denies violating the American Psychological Association's Ethical Principles and Code of Contract Conduct 3-03, Other Harassment 3.04, Avoiding Harm, and 3.09, Cooperation with Other Professionals. She states that 3.03 addresses harassing and demeaning behavior based on age, gender, gender identity, race, ethnicity, culture, and national origin, religion, sexual orientation, disability, language, or socioeconomic status. SA did not make any allegations under 3.03. Dr. Hill denies violating 3.04, reiterating that her intent was never to upset SA and denies causing SA harm. Dr. Hill claims that she abided by 3.09 by working in a professional manner and was cooperative with SA. Dr. Hill states that her adult son is ill and that she is a sole caregiver. She emphasizes that for this reason, she has essentially retired other than providing occasional services to the court. Additionally, she will not be able to appear at the meeting today because of her caregiver responsibilities. Dr. Hill asserts that this complaint is benign and should be dismissed as there are no violations of statutes, rules, or ethical codes. That concludes my summary of this case. We have a couple requests to speak. Jesse is here. Okay. Please identify yourself for the record and
give me his initials.
Use your initials.
SA.
SA. Go ahead.
I needed to mention that not only is her cell phone, Dr. Hill's cell phone, locked, but also my phone. But also my home phone blocks her numbers. I also need to mention, this was omitted from my complaint, that I filed a report with Adult Protective Services on 11/26/17 at 6:35 p.m. The report number is 20849. I think everything else speaks for itself, unless you wish to ask me questions.
Dr. Flowers, you have any questions?
Yes, I'm just several. Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, within the written complaint that you put in, you said that prescribing medication for the patient would be disregarding the Medical Practice Act current standards of care. I'm not sure. I don't really know what medical practice is. I'm not a physician. But I'm just puzzled by that, because it looks as if you went ahead and prescribed, but you were saying for some reason it's against standard of care. Is that due to that she was non-compliant or what?
I had not seen the patient in a long time, and my impression was just write the script. And it was the thing that the patient said at the visit. When I finally relented and gave her an appointment, she said, I just need a script.
Okay, one thing I've learned when seeing physicians is they don't like me to walk in and say what I want them to prescribe.
No, then you
they're not pharmacists. You don't work as a pharmacist. You have to diagnose to treat.
Yep. Yes, you have to have paperwork.
Okay, so in essence, you were asked to just kind of, I want this, therefore fill out a prescription. Don't worry about all
absolutely.
My history.
Absolutely.
You'd not seen her previous to that time?
I had not seen her since April of 2016.
Okay, so it had been at least a year with no follow-on contact with you. So that felt clinically questionable.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Brundage?
Yes, in fact, I do have questions for the doctor. One of my questions is that you mentioned, how many contacts did you actually have with Dr. Hill that you felt were hostile?
Okay.
Hello?
Hello, I'm sitting here thinking. Is that okay?
Oh, absolutely. I just didn't know if I... It was very...
Dates.
Dr. Brundage, she's looking for the information to answer your question.
Oh, thank you. It's hard to know what's going on if I can't see.
These are just some general dates that I have here. October 26th of 2017 was the call from the patient to make an appointment. On November 7th, I did an evaluation on her. So it would be between those periods and perhaps a little afterwards that the harassment occurred.
And how many incidents would you identify as harassment?
After five of her screaming at me, I just got scared. And I knew I had to not be in the same room as her. And I eventually stopped seeing patients on Fridays when she was there. And then eventually Thursdays, and then eventually I moved out. As a physician, and you as psychologist, were aware that you cannot get into a physical altercation with anyone. You have to get away. That's all I had. All I had to do was get away and feel safe.
I have additional questions before you. After you took the stand, you indicated that you had made a report to adult services with regard to what?
To her. To the way I...
And with
go ahead.
With regard to what case?
Oh, the case number I have, I mentioned that I was being harassed. At the time of the case...
So you called...
Adult Protective Services.
Correct.
For myself.
Okay. And are you aware that Adult Protective Services is generally for vulnerable adults?
And I saw myself as vulnerable.
Okay. All right. And was there an investigation?
Well, since it wasn't an immediate threat, there was no investigation. And they sent me a letter, which I do not still have, that the case would probably not was closed or something.
Okay, so it's in your impression, you believe it's closed?
Effectively, I assume that.
Okay, well, that would have been, and again, I didn't write the date. I think it was November 2017.
November 26th, 2017. And it was 6:35 p.m. The time is in my memory because I have allergy problems, and I may not have made that much sense. When you're overwhelmed with the allergies in Tucson, it's hard to talk.
Okay. All right. I don't have any further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brundage. Okay, yes, so you can go ahead and step back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Farron Akins. I'm counsel for Dr. Hill. Dr. Hill, as she mentioned in her response, regrettably didn't feel that it was a wise idea for her to try to make the trip up from Tucson today and to take time out from being pretty much the primary, if not the solo, caretaker for her adult son, who just recently had a relapse and is not doing well. However, she did want want the board to know that if you have significant questions that you really feel that you need to speak to her about, I've given her the contact information that she can call into the board. If you have any questions that you think you really need to know from her, by all means, simply let me know. I'll call her by cell phone and let her know that you would like to speak to her, and she did want to be available today. She didn't have an opening statement. She felt like her response was sufficient. She's apologetic to the complainant, but really is sort of confused and befuddled by what this is all about, and her recollection of events seems to be significantly different than what was presented today and in the complaint. But in any event, she stands by her response that she's done nothing wrong, and that, again, if you have any questions, she's willing to take the phone call for sure.
Dr. Brundage, do you have any questions?
I do, Mr. Aiken. I guess from trying to piece this together, Dr. Hill had how many interactions with the doctor?
I couldn't say how many interactions he had with her specifically about this patient in question, but they shared an office suite, and they had shared that office suite for a number of years, and all of the practitioners there knew each other. They each had their own separate practices, but it was not uncommon that they would have some interaction with each other. So I don't know that Dr. Hill would be able to give you some kind of a realistic number as to the number of times that she had any interaction with SA.
Mr. Donaldson, yes. Members of the committee, I would want to avoid the situation where Dr. Aikens is testifying because he's a lawyer in this case and not the witness. And if you have questions along the lines of what Dr. Brundage asked or want information, just recall that Dr. Aikens cannot offer testimony. And if you want Dr. Hill to be on the line, then we should make those arrangements.
I appreciate that. I'd rather not be the one testifying today either.
Thank you. Dr. Brundage, would you like to talk to Dr. Hill on the phone?
I really would, just because I'm perplexed on this case that there's such different perception of the interactions, and it would be really helpful for me to try and piece it together.
Very good. Might I have your permission to just step outside for a minute to call Dr. Hill, make sure that she has the call-in number and the passcode here?
Right. You want to just take a couple-minute break and fair, and then come back in?
Sure.
Okay.
And we'll keep the line open.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a short recess.
I thought she was going to be here before. I'm sorry.
The box is full.
Okay, we'll move on then.
Yes, sir.
And,
to another case.
To another case, and if by the end of this thing.
Do you really think so? I think at this point, I mean, we've given her an opportunity. The attorney said that she would be available. She may not come back. I mean, you know, I would think that she would be on high alert waiting for this phone call. I'm just not sure delaying is going to help that much, especially since we can't leave any message.
Yeah.
I can leave an email message.
You can?
I can.
You can?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll continue on. If by the end of this meeting, if she hasn't responded, we'll just postpone this to the next.
Or go forward. She's known that this is happening today. She did not appear. She's not answering her phone. He's not asking for continuance. I think you can proceed without her.
Okay.
Currently, would it be appropriate to continue this case at this time?
It's up to the committee. I don't see a reason to. Mr. Aikens is not asking for continuance. She opted not to be here personally, and she's not answering her phone despite attempts to reach her. I think you have the right to go on if you would like.
Mr. Chairman, my
Mr. Donaldson?
Yes, sir. Yes.
I am comfortable to go on. I do know that her response was complete, and at this point, I had just wanted to confirm the contact time, but I have some ideas on this, and I think we can proceed.
Okay.
I want to make a comment as well. I believe you're going to be handling another case later.
Two of them.
Okay. I'm wondering if we can temporarily have table or whatever, and if when you're done with the other case or two you have, hopefully she will have responded to your email, and we can hook her up on the phone and make it more complete, rather than waiting until June or something.
I do feel that would be a reasonable compromise. I'm quite certain that because you do have questions, that she would really like to be available to answer those. Right. And so if I have the procedural opportunity to request an extension, if we can't reach her, I certainly would want to do that. But I appreciate that for the moment anyways, let me once again try and leave her an email. I'll have office staff try and call her again in the meantime and see if perhaps she hears the phone to pick it up. But I appreciate your courtesy with this. And so if you will, give me a moment before we start the next case, or at least go ahead and begin the next case. And I know you'll have a report to go through. And give me then just a minute to leave a message for her on her email.
Okay, it seems to be consensus of the committee to move on with another case and to hold this until the end of the end of the committee meeting.
Thank you.
Correct. I would be in support of tabling it today, but I would not be in support of continuance. I believe that the information that she has provided is fairly complete, and she has the opportunity, if she's foregoing that opportunity, her attorney is here, and I would like to proceed, but I'm willing to table it until the end of this meeting.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
Cool.
Moving on. Thank you. Dr. Brundage, you're up next with complaint number 1832.
Correct.
Philip Lett.
Chairman Donaldson and members of the committee, I am to present RFI 18-32, Dr. Philip Lett, which is license number 1627. The complaint was based on the Arizona Board of Chiropractic Examiners had ordered VS to undergo a fitness for duty evaluation after he received a 2-year probation from his board regarding record keeping. Within that order, he had not only received continuing education requirements, but was also to see a practice monitor. After the practice monitor reviewed 2 quarters, it had been suggested that a fitness for duty would be appropriate, and he was referred at that time. VS complainant alleges that Dr. Lett conducted a, quote, full mental evaluation, unquote, and that had provided Dr. background and that he was participating under extreme duress. He also indicated that Dr. Lett was not fully aware of his type science of joint pathology and therefore should not conduct a mental evaluation. He asserts that Dr. Lett acted unethically, he delayed providing a receipt of service, and made unfounded conclusions. He expressed that the lengthy allegations against the chiropractic board, who he also felt had acted unethically. The license response, he had indicated that he had done fitness for duty evaluations since 1989 and actually had been approved by the board, chiropractic board, since 2004 to do fitness of duties in this area. He had indicated that VS had been investigated by the Board of Chiropractic Reading for record keeping and then had entered into a consent agreement. The board had received the monitor's report in that at this point they had concerns, and that's when the fitness of duty had already been ordered. Dr. Lett scheduled evaluation April 9th, 2018. VS arrived expressing confusion why the board would order such an evaluation, and that Dr. But at that time had further concerns regarding his behavior and affect that would indicate underlying pathologies. Dr. Luck conducted a brief mental status exam and indicated that there was trouble with attention, working memory, and recall. He also felt that the personality and psychopathology measures were invalid due to the defensive nature of the doctor. He felt that VS was not functioning at the expected level for someone of his background, training, and educational. At this point, he did surmise that there were possible diagnoses that needed to be further investigated under a rule-out situation. He also requested that additional testing be done and felt that his testing had some difficulties because of the defensive nature of the complainant. Dr. Lett denies he was unethical, that his recommendations for further treatment was inappropriate, and that his recommendations damaged or humiliated the complainant, that he did not feel that a receipt was provided because the Board of Chiropractic Examiners was his client. So that is a summary of this report.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brundage. We have a request to speak from VS. Please come forward.
Thank you. Well, let me go over just a few of the facts of why I'm actually here. And I've talked to many psychologists on top of it. You can't do, no matter who orders it, any type of procedure, including a mental evaluation, without a reason. And you also can't do it if, as in this case, which was explained fully to Dr. Lett, if it doing science of the pathology, which would be joint pathology, proves it should not be done. But to do that, I have to go a little bit over the science of joint pathology real quick. I try to make it's kind of complicated because it's all, you know, opinions on, I like record keeping done this way, I like it done that way, which is, you know, this we have a problem with a little bit with record keeping. But anyhow, here's how it works. In order to do chiropractic treatment and record keeping properly, first thing you have to have is a reliable way to know if the pathology was corrected or not. If you don't know that, you don't know when to see the patient again, if to see the patient again, was treatment beneficial or anything else. But the way to do that is only one way in chiropractic. According to joint pathology, joints heal permanently weaker, susceptible to re-injury for the rest of the patient's life. But when you correct them, typically the symptoms and the exams that you do to find it improve right after treatment before the patient leaves the treatment room. However, if you wait just one day, that joint could re-injure with returning of the symptoms and the positive findings, making the results unreliable. Therefore, the only way you can possibly do it is to record improved symptoms and exams if they occur right after treatment, if they did or didn't occur. On top of that, if they didn't, you can recheck and retreat, thereby increasing the percentage of time that you actually can get a patient well. Now, here's where the actual problem comes in. Some people, like me, I document improved symptoms and exams right after treatment on every patient, every visit. Not all doctors do that. So there's a difference of record keeping. Some do, some don't. And I don't care the ones that don't, but you shouldn't punish the ones that do, because if you document that, and at the time they made the order, I had actually documented, I think, over 100, because they monitored me, over 100 in a row for improved symptoms and exams right after treatment, which is the best indicator that you corrected the pathology, which you must know. But anyhow, it does three things when you document that. Number one, it proves that everything on the doctor's records had to have been accurate and well, correct and done properly. Otherwise, you couldn't have reached that highest result. It also proves treatment was beneficial, necessary, and, beneficial and necessary and did no harm, obviously. The third thing, which is the important one it proves, is it doesn't just happen. You don't just produce improved symptoms and exams right after treatment unless the doctor has the knowledge and the skills and the mental ability to do it. So it proves right there, especially with 100 in a row, that you're fit and safe to practice according to science. Now, I don't believe, frankly, well, the monitoring company, when I kind of wrote them a letter in, to explain this, because the things monitoring companies doesn't like, they don't want to, and at the time I didn't realize that they were doing this. You can't take joint path, well, if you correct the joint injury, it proves that everything on the records had to have been, that you need to improve, well, to produce that result, had to have been correct and done properly. They were using those things to actually say doctors had bad records. So they exposed them, and so they didn't like it. And they recommended to the board that we need a mental evaluation, possibly to cover up the fact that they don't like this. And that was kind of the problem. But the board order reads, ordered me to do a mental evaluation to determine if I'm fit and safe to practice. Science proves I am, therefore there was no reason to do this. As we all know, I can't do something as a doctor unless I have a reason to do it. Like you, open heart, cardiologists can't do open heart surgery no matter who orders it, just because if there's no reason to do it, because that's an endangerment to the patient. Same with a mental evaluation or anything else. You can't do it for no reason. Even Dr. Letts said, what's your reason? And he couldn't come up with a reason to do it. That's my big complaint. It was done. All the other stuff, I don't care about. I was under duress. He obviously knew I didn't want to do it. But I had to.
I say, could you please summarize, conclude your comments?
Okay. Well, basically, my whole thing is, it should never have been done, because it was in violation, the order was in violation of science, and so there was no reason to do it, and a doctor can't do a mental evaluation without a reason, and that's what many have told. In fact, one actually turned it down after Dr. Lett made his recommendation, saying you have no reason to have this done. But that's what I'm really on. I don't want doctors to just do something to do it just because somebody recommends or orders it. It should have a reason, and there was no reason here. That's my summary. That's what the whole complaint is about. You can't just have doctors just, we'll do a mental evaluation even though there's no reason to do it. We also did a substance abuse test with no reason. That was put in after the fact. Remember, I'm a 60 at the time, 61-year-old man, never done drugs in my life, adversely against recreational drugs, never been on medication, only drink occasionally. And so why would you possibly do a substance abuse evaluation and charge for it? And plus, they charge you money. I think that's, if there's no reason to do it, it's essentially, I believe, fraud. But why would you do that? Well, there's no reason. The board didn't even ask if I drank alcohol or ever did drugs. They just threw it out.
Okay, yes, see.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. That's your time.
Yeah, that's all I really, that's my only point there. That's all I'm coming here for.
Okay, thank you. Hold on. Dr. Brundy, do you have any questions?
I sure do. Thank you very much for coming in. I know this is difficult. I have carefully reviewed all your material. I know that the first complaint that you provided was 14 pages single-spaced. And along that complaint, most of it was directed towards concerns that you had with regard to the Board of Chiropractic Areas. I am aware that within that board, you had signed a consent agreement agreeing to go for 2 years probation, practice monitoring, and additional CE in record keeping. Were you aware of the fact that you were in a probationary status and that they could ask for additional information?
Oh, yeah, you gotta understand, you have two choices. Lose your license, abandon your patients, or do what they say. That's pretty much it. I don't have a choice. Of course, I have to do what they say.
All right, so you were clear that you had signed a consent agreement and agreed to follow the direction of the board.
Oh, yeah, under duress, everybody's going to do that, because the alternative, you're out of practice. You have no real choice there.
And then you had followed up with a letter, again, of 2 pages single space, with additional information, but again, most of your concerns are regarding the the consent agreement you had signed regarding probation.
Well, the problem, like I say, with all of it comes back to record keeping. One type of doctor's record keeping documents improved symptoms and exams right after treatment, the other doesn't. And I've actually written a book on it, to be honest. And it's so, it would take a long time to all the differences that creates. But there's a lot of difference between the two. But unfortunately, the doctors that document improved symptoms and exams right after think the ones that don't are doing record keeping wrong, and vice versa. So it's kind of a war in record keeping. But that should not go into, our war should not go into who's ever in power decides, well, we're going to throw in a mental evaluation just because you believe that record keeping should include improved symptoms and exams right after treatment to determine if the pathology was corrected or not. And that's really the only big difference between mine and the other way to do it.
Okay. I'm also looking, and I would dictate this to our other committee members, on page 60 of 216 pages, there is a consent for mental health evaluation that outlines that the State of Arizona Board of Chiropractic Examiners has requested this, and that in stated the order, case number 2018-2024, to undergo this. It had outlined the cost of this that would be incurred by you, and I do see that you've signed the consent agreement, and also it had been witnessed. That happened on April 9th, 2018. Did you sign this?
Yeah, I would have signed anything to protect the health and well-being of my patients if the alternatives I forced to abandon them and endanger their health and well-being. Once again, we don't have a lot of choices here. This is it's under duress, but if, I mean, equivalent of, they hold a gun on someone's head and say, I'm going to pull the trigger. If you don't sign this, well, I'm going to sign it.
And did you believe that you had the mental capacity to understand what this said and find it without being impaired?
Yeah, I understood it. I understood also, like you should understand, we really don't have a choice. There's a choice of abandoning your patient, letting them suffer, or sign it. Those are the facts. And I think you understand perfectly that's how it works. I don't have control over that board. They have basically the control of God over my license. And if I don't obey them, I'll lose it. I lose it. I abandon my patients. And their health and well-being is in jeopardy if they can't find somebody that they can hopefully can find somebody. But, you know, I have a pretty high cure ratio, as you noticed, 100 in a row of improved symptoms and exams right after. And not all doctors document that way.
Okay. I believe that the Board of Chiropractic Examiners has similar goals as to the Board of Psych Examiners, which is to protect the public. I have no further questions at this point, Mr. Donaldson.
Thank you, Dr. Brundage. Dr. Flowers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, I'm obviously not a chiropractor. I don't know if there's a lot of specialist training to get that done. But I'm wondering if the science of pathology is something that is taught for people trying to become licensed as chiropractors.
Oh, yeah. Of course, we have all the sciences. And science of joint pathology is one of them, obviously. It's the main one that dictates. In other words, chiropractic treats joint injuries, and therefore it must follow the science of joint pathology. Now, there's a whole lot of politics in finances, this gets really technical. Like, insurance companies like to use statistical guesses to cut chiropractic bills, but to do that, they actually switch to a bone injury model because chiropractic, but it gets really detailed. I don't know if you want to go into that much of it.
I might need to have at least a 101 course in chiropractic to understand.
Okay.
That's okay. I'm just trying to figure out. I've never heard of that theory before, or science of joint pathology, so I'm just wondering.
Well, joint pathology is just the science of the study of joints. Like, there's two models, joint injury model and bone injury model. You already know the bone injury. Bone injury, Simple fracture heals as good as new in 6 to 8 weeks. Joint injury, it heals permanently weaker, susceptible to re-injury for the rest of the patient's life. They're kind of opposites. Different tissues heal in different ways, but those are the two injury models. See what I mean?
I'm wondering if the people that you bill to, do they find your record keeping to be acceptable as far as processing?
Well, they now have everything. Never does it. Insurance companies, well, here's what they don't like. When you document improved symptoms and exams right after treatment, that's the highest level of proof that treatment was necessary, because that means you corrected the pathology, which is what you're supposed to do. They hate that because joints heal permanently weaker, and therefore they'd have to use that as treatment necessity rather than the statistical guess they normally use. That's why they don't like it. It's all finance. I've actually written a book in this field. Do you understand how the...
Well, I guess what I'm saying specifically is when insurance companies ask for your documentation, record keeping, when you submit a bill, do they find it to be acceptable for what they...
Yeah, I've never had problems with any of them except the one time they did turn me in this time. I actually wrote on the end of it a report that explained the science why you should use improve symptoms and exams right after as the proof for treatment necessity rather than their statistical guess. And they didn't like that, so they turned me into the board. I had documented improved symptoms and exams on the patient they turned me in for on every visit. In fact, the defense attorney wrote a letter that said I had some of the best records he's ever seen. He'd been in practice 25 years. And the opposite one obviously says they hated my records, all for the same reason. I documented improved symptoms and exams after treatment. Now I do all the other stuff, the case history, everything else. That's the difference.
Okay.
And you understand that. Well, let me ask you one question. If you're an insurance company, joints are permanently weaker. You take every person that gets in an auto accident in a year or over years, and you got to make a settlement based on the rest of their life, or you can cut it off in an X amount of time because you're using a bone injury model that heals as good as new in 6 to 8 weeks. Which would you rather do financially? And that's the big problem we're having.
Okay, just let me kind of go back to the other issue. I think Dr. Brundage covered it already, but I'll just ask you as well. From what I gather, the Board of Chiropractic, I'm probably given not the totally correct name, they basically told you you needed to have this mental health evaluation. And do you understand that, well, do you disagree that Dr. Lett could not do it even though...
No, it shouldn't have been done because science, because I explained it to him, according to science, if you document 100 times in the highest level of proof that you're fit and safe to practice is that you documented, you corrected the pathology right after treatment. There is no higher proof that you are.
Okay.
Now, he knew that, and he understood all of the other factors involved, and yet did it anyhow, and that's my complaint. He shouldn't do something without reason, and he shouldn't do it when he knows it's a violation of science, no matter who orders it.
Okay, but apparently the board requested it?
You know, they ordered it because, well,
okay.
You got to realize, if you're not doing that, people that do it, say that you're evaluating as an evaluator, and you're using things that science, if you document it, science proves, remember, that everything on your records was correct and done properly, whatever it took to do that. If you're using those things, or you're being restricted that you can't use that because science proves what you're doing is wrong, you're not going to like it, and no matter who you are as an evaluator. That's why some evaluators don't like documenting approved symptoms and exams after, because of what science proves about the records. And if they use something on there, they're proven to be in violation of science, which is obviously wrong. I know, I'm pretty sure the monitoring company didn't like that. That's when I wrote that letter, that's why they did it, because that injures the way they make money.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. I have no questions. SA, would you please step
back? Well, actually, it's a VS. SA was the last one.
Or VS?
Yeah.
Would you please step back?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
I believe Dr. Lett is on the phone.
Okay. Dr. Lett is on the phone. Dr. Lett?
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead and...
Let me just state my appearance.
Okay.
I'm Farron Akins. I'm counsel for Dr. Lett, and I know Dr. Lett does have some comments he'd like to share with you.
Okay. Dr. Lett, go ahead.
I want to thank you for allowing me to address the committee today. This all stems from a psychological work fitness evaluation that I conducted at the request of the Arizona Board of Chiropractic Examiner. The Board of Chiropractic issued an interim order for complainant to undergo a mental health evaluation, including substance abuse evaluation, to help determine his fitness for duty and safety to practice. Subsequently, complainant contacted my office and voluntarily scheduled the mental health evaluation. The Board of Chiropractic accepted his nomination of me as the evaluator. Committee members have seen the complaint filed against me. I want you to know that I've been providing psychological work fitness evaluations in Arizona with healthcare professionals for 30 years. Over the years, I've conducted several dozen psychological work fitness evaluations referred by the Board of Chiropractic, focusing on whether the chiropractor being evaluated had the ability to safely practice in Arizona from a psychological perspective. The mental health evaluation I conducted with complainant, my office, was consistent with my normal procedure for conducting psychological work fitness evaluations of chiropractors and other healthcare professionals. Complainant was not treated any differently than other healthcare professionals undergoing work fitness evaluations. Complainant denied any history of medical, mental health, or substance abuse issues, or any remarkable psychosocial stressors in his life besides the Board of Chiropractic matter. Complainant presented a lack of insight into why the Board of Chiropractic issued the interim order that he undergo a mental health evaluation. He was clearly unhappy with the Board of Chiropractic. He seemed to think I was collaborating with the Board of Chiropractic against him. Strongly believed the Board of Chiropractic action was just an abuse of power. However, based on my evaluation, complainant exhibited a concerning pattern of psychological...
Dr. Lett, this is Jean Galvin, the board's assistant attorney general. I would ask that you refrain from disclosing findings or conclusions from the evaluation. That's protected health information. If the committee has specific questions about your findings or conclusions or the methods of evaluation, I would ask that we would go into executive session. They have the evaluation, and if they have questions, we will go into executive session.
Thank you.
All right. On November the 19th, 2018, I received a notification from the Board of Psychologist Examiners that complainant had filed a complaint against me. Complainant alleges my conducting the evaluation with him was unethical practice and fraudulent. Complainant writes that Dr. Lett, quote, should not have done a mental evaluation on complainant. Dr. Lett was fully aware the science of joint pathology proved a mental health evaluation should not be done on complainant, but violated science to do it anyway, end quote. Complainant further wrote, quote, complainant's above probable world record is the highest level of proof that complainant is fit and safe to practice. Dr. Lett was fully aware of complainant's above probable world record, what it meant according to science, end quote. Complainant's written expressions and allegations, as just mentioned, demonstrate psychological concern identified and discussed in the mental health evaluation written report that was provided to both the Board of Chiropractic and complainant. It is noteworthy that complainant expresses the above complaint despite the fact that he was not in compliance with his probation agreement with the Board of Chiropractic and agreed to comply with the Board of Chiropractic interim order to undergo a mental health evaluation to help determine his fitness for duty and safety to practice. This evaluator did not violate ethical standards or commit fraud as alleged by complainant. In addition, the complaint filed against me is unfounded. It's respectfully requested the committee dismiss this complaint. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Dr. Brunt, do you have any questions?
I have no further questions of the doctor at this time.
Dr. Flowers?
No questions at this time. Thank you.
Sir, you already had your time? Yes, sit down, please. Mr. Akins?
No, thank you.
No comments? Okay, Dr. Atkins, could you please step back?
Sure.
Okay, VS, can you come forward and make another statement? But please keep it short.
Be very short.
I was only going to address one thing statistically. When they monitored me at the end, I had produced, 150 in a row of improved symptoms and exams right after treatment, before the patient left the treatment room. That is a possible world record in producing that number. I don't know if anybody monitored has ever done higher than that. And that's what I was referring to. And that also, remember, is the highest level of proof that you are fit and safe to practice. So when he referred to the world record, possible, because it's hard to verify, but I don't know if anybody has higher in a row than that. So that's all I wanted to address when you stated that. And so it's not bragging or anything else, it's just a fact. And it's a relative fact, because that's what really determines if you're fit, safe to practice, and if you are, you shouldn't be doing a mental evaluation to figure it out.
Okay, thank you. Committee will now begin deliberation. Please note deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. Dr. Brundage, would you please begin the deliberation?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Donaldson. I'm aware that in this case we seem to get lost in the weeds, and I know that there is a lot described by VS with regard to his science in joint pathology. Again, that is more focused to the experts on the chiropractic board. We're focused on the mental health issues, and again, the claim was that it was unethical and inappropriate. In looking at the material, I find that the informed consent is complete, that the order seems to be complete, that the report from the doctor is comprehensive, it is professional, 8 pages of the formal report, and then the supporting documents all indicate that he followed appropriate guidelines for psychometric testing, and that the results that he came up with were certainly in line with the testing that he had done. He was very upfront about the limitations of his test. I believe that at this point, I would like to make a motion for dismissal.
I second the motion.
Further discussion? Dr. Flowers, any further discussion?
Well, I just wanted to say the complainant basically is feeling that he is professionally adequate in his profession. As Dr. Brundage mentioned, that is something for them to decide, but the psychologist was asked to provide a psychological service rather than agree or disagree with the chiropractic skills of the complainant, and he was under order to do the evaluation, and reading through it, it appears it was done appropriately, and the conclusions were also appropriate.
Thank you. Dr. Brundage and Dr. Lett also emphasize that the VS agreed to the terms of the consent agreement with the BC, voluntarily scheduled evaluation with him, and signed the informed consent acknowledging the purpose of the evaluation. And there's nothing that I've heard that supports the allegations, and I'll just call for the question. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed by the same sign, motion carries. Complaint number 18-32 is dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on.
I have been able to reach Dr. Hill by phone and call him to do his conference back and let her know it's okay. Call him in whenever you like. If you want to ensure matters next, the third complaint is dealt with, that's entirely.
Okay, let's go on to 18-34. And Dr. Brundage, that's you again.
It is me. I hope you're not getting tired of my talking. I would like to present a brief summary of RFI 18-34 against Scott Padilla, ID, licensed August 11th, 2017, with a license number of 44881. The complaint was submitted by the ex-husband of Dr. Padilla's patient. Ex-wife began counseling July or August of 2017. AES is a complainant and believes that ex-wife and Dr. Padilla had a sexual relationship during their therapeutic relationship. The complainant described reconnecting with his wife in 2011 and having being married and having two children within a three-year period. He indicated that during that early part of their marriage, stressors increased and the couple was challenged regarding life events. Wife chose to reinitiate therapy and found Dr. Padilla in the middle of 2017. AC indicates that shortly after his ex-wife began therapy that their marriage began falling apart, and that's quotations. Ex-wife appeared to be increasingly angry with the complainant and blamed him for troubles in the marriage. AC attended one session with Dr. Padilla and alleges that his wife was attracted to the doctor. Shortly thereafter, he expressed concerns that his ex-wife and the doctor were having an affair. At that point, the wife denied that and indicated that. AC then noted that there were a lot of texts and that his wife had been secretive with her phone. He, at that time, had drawn up a draft of divorce papers in December, but things improved and he accepted a position in Seattle January 2018. Complainant alleges that Dr. Padilla and his ex-wife text more frequently and had extended telephone calls frequently after at night or during non-business hours. On June 25, 2018, AC alleges that he found evidence that Dr. Padilla and his ex-wife had a sexual relationship. He had gone through ex-wife's journal, which confirmed the affair. Divorce was finalized November 26, 2018. AC alleges that wife confessed to his affair with Dr. Padilla. Wife's last session with Dr. Padilla was April 25, 2018, where it was alleged that there was prolonged kissing and oral sex. After receiving the complaint, licensee responded in a appropriate fashion. He firmly disputes allegations and states that he never has had physical contact with the ex-wife, has never engaged in sexual relationship with a current or former client, never has had an emotional relationship with a client, does not have a sister or know Vicky, never been sexually abused, and never engaged in self-harming behaviors. Licensee began treatment with the ex-wife July 2017 through Sunlight Center for Change, concerned with the diagnosis and concurred with the diagnosis of the previous therapist. Husband was seen in one session, and Dr. Padilla thought that the session went well. Sometime in October 2017, ex-wife contacted office and canceled all of her appointments. At that time, she expressed concern that she felt an attraction to licensee, that no one could help her, and that doctor was manipulating her into, quote, needing him. Dr. Padilla continued because a pattern of early termination was often a symptom of the diagnosis that he had given. November 28th, he discussed transference with ex-wife and expressed concern that she had, quote, a crush on him. Discussing again December 1st, transference issues along with February 28th, 2018. Dr. Padilla acknowledges that after termination of therapeutic relation that ex-wife would contact him. He did not see that contact as, quote, therapeutic, unquote, acknowledges that he crossed boundaries, acknowledged that he knew she would used the journal, however, was unaware of the content. On November 27, 2018, board received the communications from ex-wife who adamantly denied having an affair with Dr. Padilla. That is a summary of this case.
Thank you, Dr. Brundage. We have a request to speak from Dr. Padilla.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to appear.
Please identify yourself.
Sorry, my name is Dr. Scott Padilla.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you all today. I fully support and believe in the purpose of the board's protection of the public and the investigation process that goes along with that. And that sentiment does not change when the allegations are against me. The allegations against me are serious. My ex-client's ex-husband believes that his ex-wife and I had an affair. He found a personal journal of my ex-client in her phone that were pretty disturbing, and understandably, he has concerns about what the content was. I also realize that he does not understand necessarily that people with his ex-wife's diagnosis frequently fantasize and write things of this nature. And at the same time, I also realized that if I had a wife who I found a journal that was discussing graphic fantasies with her therapist, I too would be upset and quite disturbed. So therefore, there's not been any anger or resentment that has accompanied my response to this complaint. I focused on addressing the complainant's concerns so that he can move forward believing that he's done all that he needs to do that makes him feel like he did what was right with the information that he had. The majority of time spent in therapy with this particular client was focused on his relationship with her, improving that relationship. As was stated, I was aware that she had an attraction to me. In my clinical training, I was taught that healthy boundaries can be taught to a client through modeling and maintaining those boundaries. That seemed to be the case with this client. In person, she seemed to be respecting those boundaries quite well, and I was unaware that that was not so much the case in her fantasy world. I do acknowledge that some boundary crossing did occur with this client. I also believe strongly that sometimes boundary crossing is necessary and appropriate with a client. This particular client's ex-husband's job required that he relocate to Seattle, and that resulted in early termination or premature termination of my services to her. And that raised some serious concerns on my part of her stability and safety. So the intent on my part of maintaining some transitional contact with her while she sought a new therapist, not as her therapist anymore, but as a support while she was seeking out a new therapist, that was the purpose of that contact. Initially, that contact was a bit frequent. My client was experiencing a lot of panic. Eventually, that contact tapered off. And, to reiterate, no boundary violations occurred, nothing illegal, nothing inappropriate transpired between she and I just really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today to reiterate those facts, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have.
Thank you. Dr. Brundage?
I do. Thank you, Dr. Padilla, for being here. I know it's very difficult, but obviously the concerns are grave, and at this point, really trying to figure out what's happening. The information that you submitted, I noted that in the informed consent, you had several various forms of informed consent. One was out of the Board of Behavioral Health, and and examiners, and then it followed through. I'm looking, and again, this is indicated for the committee chairs or committee people, page 198 of 341. You indicate that Sunlight Center for Change has a media policy and therapeutic relationship. When was this developed?
The form about a media policy was developed after the complaint had been filed. In discussions with my attorney, this was a suggestion that he made that I do that. Within our...
All right.
I'm sorry, may I continue? There's a piece to our intake paperwork where we have an Arizona Disclosure of Information form that on it is a paragraph about contact outside of session, but it was not a formal form until since the complaint was filed.
Thank you for the clarification, because I did note that it had not been signed. I also had looked at the collateral consent, and that had not been signed either.
Correct.
That's post-complaint.
Correct.
All right. I am aware that we have received some information with regard to telephone calls and emails. I think that in looking at the telephone call log, it was difficult for me to pick out what calls were made to your number or to other numbers that you may be calling from. But I know that with the email history, I found it very alarming that a lot of these emails were done at night. There's one Friday, November 3rd, 2017 at 8:37 in the evening. Do you normally interface with clients or patients at that time?
I am actually in the office. My last client tends to leave at 8, and I'm usually in the office after that, doing just that, the correspondence that I didn't get a chance to do during the day when I had the back-to-back clients all day tend to pile up, and then after people leave for the evening, I'm still there kind of cleaning up and closing down shop, including email and correspondence of that nature.
Okay. Do you have records of your text messages with this client?
I do not.
Because I know that is one of the alleged problems that the ex-husband had, that there was frequently a lot of texting and emailing. And certainly the email, some of the content was a bit disturbing to me. Now, you've openly admitted, and I thank you for your candidness, that you crossed boundaries. What boundaries do you identify that you have violated?
Just so I can clarify, madam, you're asking which boundaries I feel I violated?
Correct, because you've acknowledged that in your response that you did violate, that you did cross boundaries.
Correct, yeah. I do not believe that I violated any boundaries. I acknowledge that I did cross boundaries.
Okay. Help me understand the difference.
Sure. I believe that, like I stated earlier, I think that there are times where crossing boundaries might be necessary to ensure a client's safety or to ensure a client's stability, and it's in the better interest of the client's overall well-being. Whereas a violation is pretty clear. I think the sexual contact with a client, any kind of inappropriate relationships, any kind of, unethical type activity, those kinds of things are pretty clear-cut violations, whereas I think when you're talking about crossing, it's a little bit more gray, and, having to sort of on the fly decide whether or not in this instance this is something that I feel is in the better interest of the client, which is in no way intentionally harmful or malicious.
After termination of treatment, you continued to communicate with this patient for how long?
There was a period of time where she was seeking a therapist. She got a therapist, and then there was a window of time that she was with her therapist where we didn't speak, and then apparently she stopped seeing that therapist, and then there was some more time. This was a year ago at this point, and it's really difficult for me to recall exactly, but it was a bit sporadic, and as I said, it was pretty frequent at first when she first got up there, and then it tapered off.
Okay. And you state clearly that there was never any kind of sexual involvement. How do you deal with, I saw in your notes several times that you indicated transference.
Right.
But as you know, with this type of population, what kind of boundaries did you provide under to protect yourself with regard to her crush or any of those kind of things?
So
it seemed like you talked about it, but that's where it ended, and you continued to see her.
Sure. So I had to dig deep into my training experience to recall how, you know, supervisors had handled this kind of situation in the past, or not necessarily direct supervisors, but people who had been in the field for a long time, longer than me, obviously, at that point. And any time that the issue of a client expressing affection for the therapist came up, in my experience, the response was never terminate with the client. And the response was, this can be a very powerful teaching opportunity for this client who you know has potentially come to you after a lifetime of abuse or trauma or inappropriate boundaries or you know vulnerable predation type situations, and you can have this opportunity to be the one that doesn't do it that way, that shows what being appropriate and having boundaries looks like. And if you terminate with that client just because now they are starting to push those boundaries, then you're missing that opportunity to provide that the educational experience for them. So my response to this client when she tried to terminate was, okay, I respect that decision if that's what you want to do, but I would also like to put it out there that it's possible we can use this to work forward from and potentially strengthen your ability to understand that, you know, you don't have to run away when something starts to look fuzzy. You can actually clarify and learn from it and grow from it. And, you know, in her life at the time, this client was looking to me for examples of what it's supposed to be like when a male and a female are interacting appropriately. And so I told her that, yeah, we can discharge if that's what you want to do. But I also, like I said, went back to my training in my mind and said, I should probably offer the opportunity for us to not terminate just because this is starting to look scary for her, and use it as an opportunity to prove or show what healthy boundaries do look like, or what healthy boundaries being maintained looks like. So I have those conversations, I have those discussions, and I think that working with a population that comes to the table with blurred boundaries and a sense of what boundaries look like from their own experience, they don't know what that looks like, and I actually welcome the opportunity to be that model of healthy interaction that maybe they haven't had before.
Did you consult with a supervisor, a colleague, about this case?
Not in a, hey, I need to sit down and talk about this particular case because it's getting really difficult. And I say that because at the time, I didn't feel like it was difficult. I felt like I was doing it the way that I had been trained to do it. And like I said in my statement, the appearance of her understanding and adhering to those boundaries was good in person. She didn't cross the room. She was on the couch over there and I was on the chair over here. And if she said something like, oh, I have these crush feelings on you, it wasn't like she was standing up and moving towards me and saying, I have these crush feelings on you. It was, I have these feelings, just like she would say any other feelings she was experiencing or any other difficulty she was having with something, she would say it and I would validate and reflect and we would talk about it and it would move on. When I did sort of casually mention this to my peers and my office, the response was, document, make sure that, everything is airtight so that if, anything happens, God forbid, down the road, that you've got your ducks in a row. And at the time, I believe that that's what I had accomplished. Now, obviously, in hindsight, here we are, and I wish now that I had done things a lot differently. I have since gone and specifically sought out continuing education opportunities to focus on boundaries and ethics and social media and these difficult issues that had I more fully immersed myself in the education that's out there about it, I feel as though I would have been more well prepared, such as having that collateral form and having that social media policy stated up front and talking about, having supervision about these kinds of cases that are documented, that are formal, that are meant to protect you and not allow these gray areas to become black areas. So I have been enlightened quite a bit since November of 2018.
Thank you. I have no questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Runge, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for coming to explain what occurred. I have similar concerns, but I wanted to share one of them that maybe is the crux of all this. It would have to do with the multiple relationships and boundary crossings, is what was talked about before. Looking through some of the email messages, there's one that the time is said it was Wednesday the 4th of October 2017 at 12:37 a.m., which is kind of an unusual time. But within that, you're talking to the client you had, and you indicated that you'd done good work, but you also went on to say, my door is always open for check-in visits and booster shots after we officially discharge. I'm still in contact with many of my past clients. Some I see in Virginia visiting. Some I get email updates on the random text messages saying hello. And, some of the email messages she sent to you, one of them was, why are you ignoring me, Scott? It's kind of like she was annoyed that she had to write an email message because she hadn't responded to text messages. I'm just speculating. But it's very fuzzy here about, and then booster shots and all that. So that kind of indicates an ongoing therapeutic relationship after termination. And it sounds, and it doesn't say in here, but when you visit Virginia, do you look up people you worked with? I mean, there are all these things that caring about the client, but then getting too involved, I guess, can be problematic.
Absolutely.
Also within the informed consent that you had for her is back in August 25th, 2017. To me, it was confusing, maybe needs to be modified. It says regulation of psychotherapy practice. The practice of licensed clinical psychology is regulated
regulated by the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, and that you're a doctoral level psychologist provided by the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, and then it gives the number, excuse me, the name and address of the Arizona Board of Behavioral Examiners, Behavioral Health Examiners. So I'm curious how that would be. I mean, because you're here in front of the psychology board, not in front of the behavioral health board. Is that something that, is that problematic for you? To me, it's a little bit inappropriate.
That is actually a surprise to me. I know that when I came on to work at the center I work at, that those forms were sort of provided for me to use. I completely agree that should not say behavioral health examiners, and I'm not sure. I'm wondering if that is because the form that the administrative person at the time used to give as my consent form might have been the one of the social work or other therapists under the roof that they were using, and maybe that person did not use the right form. And I honestly, I'm
okay. Well, I guess sometimes when you go to an organization, you kind of get what they there. A lot of people don't know the difference between different
right.
professions. Some people think I'm a psychiatrist.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I didn't go that route. I make less money.
But I do want to make sure that all my forms have the right board on it.
Well, and also apparently another psychologist there who was providing doctoral supervision, like before you had this client, had the same form saying,
I can't.
Oh, Dr. Kristen, I think I can say it, Dr. Christian Swartz was, I think, getting supervision from Dr. Holly Gilbert. I may be saying the name wrong, but it's the same form. But anyway, that's just something to clean up,
absolutely.
It looks like.
Yes, thank you for that.
And I, again, saw many email messages. What is and was your policy on email? I mean, within the one that I mentioned, the email message, some of them just sound as if you're providing services, you know, like you're providing therapy by, I don't know about text message, but certainly by email.
Sure.
So I'm wondering what your policy is and was for that, and what kind of billing arrangements, if any, are for that.
Yes. Yeah, so again, this is more of the what falls under the umbrella of things I wish I had known then and that I know now. I have always sort of been willing to be available for emergency scheduling issues or, you know, absolute things that can't wait till the next session without really feeling like I don't want to nickel and dime people for, you know, 2 seconds or 2 minutes that I wrote an email for or read an email. Obviously, with this population, that availability I have learned is more often abused than not, and since again this complaint, I have gone and made sure that the social media or electronic communication policy that is now in effect states that kind of interaction is no longer on the table or is not something that's offered or available. If there's emergencies, you know, 911 is the number to call, not me. And, you know, and I, again, I think this is a one of those things that I'm learned sort of through the fire here that is a need of mine to tighten up on. And that is something that I have done, but at the time had not yet done.
Yeah, thank you. Also, within your consent for treatment form back in 2017, you indicated there was a crisis line and didn't say anything about contact otherwise. So not sure if that, you know, the client in question here, if she had, you told her that, hey, you need to use this rather than midnight conversations or whatever?
You know, and again, I feel like my decision since this complaint has been that I am not at the point where I feel as equipped as I thought I was to work with this population. And I have decided and chosen to now forego seeing this population anymore until at some point I decide to go and immerse myself in all the areas to learn about this population. But lost my train of thought, I'm sorry. At the time, I felt that this person wasn't necessarily in crisis, but that her need for validation or her need for whatever, I felt would go far in building that rapport and that therapeutic relationship that she can trust, that she, you know, she had expressed so many times how you're just gonna abandon me like everybody else did. You're just gonna, you know, drop me like everyone else has. I can't trust you. I can't count on you. And so there were many opportunities where I felt, okay, this is an opportunity I have to prove otherwise, to be there when she needs somebody. And again, in hindsight, wish I hadn't. In foresight, won't. But in the meantime, here I am having to answer these questions. So.
Thank you. Yes, there's it's a balancing act about being supportive without too much intrusion or dependency. But yeah, thank you for your answers to my questions.
Thank you. Dr. Brundage, do you have any follow-up questions?
I do not at this time.
Okay. I think Dr. Brundage has pretty well asked questions or that I might have covered. I know one thing she said, and it was brought up, is contact emails. And it seems like you didn't follow your own advice that you got from other people's document. When I was in business, we were instructed document, particularly when you might have to use the services of an attorney, document. It makes his job a lot easier than trying to fumble through all this other stuff. A very difficult case, as I said, and I read this stuff in my 18 years on this board is one thing I have learned is document. And if you aren't doing that, you're shooting yourself in the foot. And some of the acknowledgments you made in your response to the board is you said there was a lot of things that you could do better, and you're attempting to do things better by furthering your education. Mr. Akins, do you have any comments?
May I just check with you to see that you received the copies of the CE certificates he had taken in the course of trying to upgrade some of his knowledge and skills?
Yes, we got those emailed.
Very good. All right, thank you.
And AC is on the line.
AC is on the line, okay.
He was at one point.
AC,
I still am.
Okay. Go ahead and make your comments, sir.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being willing to hear this case. As you can imagine, this has been a very difficult year for both me and my children. Briefly, I just want to state the impact that this has had. Since this has occurred, my ex-wife, you know, the mother of my children, has become very emotionally unstable. According to what she's told me, and I understand, I actually know a fair amount about this population myself because my father was diagnosed with a similar condition. And I was raised by someone with it, and I actually have some caretaker tendencies, which is probably part of why I ended up in the relationship with my ex-wife. But setting that aside, she stated to me that she's attempted suicide. I've directly observed her being very emotionally unstable. She's harassed me, shown up at my place of residence, shouting outside my window. She's threatened me, especially with filing this report. I was threatened by her dozens of times in the time between when I initially requested she move out of our residence and when I actually filed the report. I believe it was 3 weeks after I finalized our divorce. This incident, this case, directly led to the end of our marriage. Now, obviously, there was a lot of other issues in our marriage, and I won't gloss over that or minimize them, but the reason why I ultimately stopped even attempting to maintain the marriage was, as I wrote in my report, which I realize is lengthy, that I had told her at the time I discovered the affair, and she initially said, yes, it happened, and then she recanted and said, no, it didn't. I told her, I said, I will never know for certain if it did or did not happen. But if you want to salvage our marriage, the one thing you have to do right now is cease contact with Dr. Padilla. She said she was unwilling to do that because he was providing a service she required, whether it's technically therapeutic or not, that's for you guys to determine, but that she needed him in order to maintain her mental health and stability at that point. In the interest of trying to save our marriage, I relented and I said, okay, fine, but they had been communicating in Snapchat up until that point and in text message, and she deleted all those text messages, so those are lost on that end. And so they were communicating everything else in Snapchat, which, as you may or may not know, is designed to hide conversations. After you send a message, it's permanently deleted. So it can never be recovered by anybody, including law enforcement. It's gone. And I told her, I said, you cannot communicate with him anymore in Snapchat. That is the one line I will draw, because that app is designed to hide conversations. And she agreed. And it was a week after that agreement, we were hanging out together at my residence, and we were watching a movie, and I saw her sending a message in Snapchat, and I casually asked her, who are you talking to? She said, I'm talking to Scott. And I said, that was the one line I told you you couldn't cross. And she tried to minimize it and gloss over it, and I said, okay. And the next day, I dropped off the remaining stuff, and I said, I'm done. I'm out. Because she couldn't even respect that one small boundary. I'm really concerned by the fact that Dr. Pia claims she doesn't have copies of those text messages. The reason why I'm so concerned is because I told him back in June or July of last year when all of this was going on, and the dates should be in my report, and I just don't have time to read through them right now, that I was going to file a complaint. And to me, if I had exonerating evidence that would clarify to a board looking at my licensure exactly what was said between me and the client in question, I would want to keep that. I understand why my ex-wife doesn't want to keep it, because she straight up told me she was trying to protect Scott. But to me, it's really questionable why he would get rid of those messages, why he wouldn't have access to them when he knew full well that this was going to come up at some point. Again, I won't draw any conclusions myself. I'll leave that to you guys. But to me, that's really concerning that he admitted he had them at one point and now does not. With that being said, I've been in therapy myself over this. I've been on a lot of medication. As you can imagine, it's made me question the psychological community as a whole. Obviously, we're all human beings. But as Dr. Padilla told me when I called him and initially confronted him over this, transference is common. And as I have asked, I know several therapists, as in the back of my report that I submitted, I listed one in particular who's a friend of the mother of one of my close friends who's a sheriff's deputy in Minnesota. And my understanding is that when a patient expresses feelings for a therapist, and as strong as feelings as Naomi expressed, that's the point at which the relationship is supposed to end. And as Dr. Padilla even admitted himself, when she expressed those concerns, he actually was the one who told her that it may be an opportunity for the therapy to advance to another stage, another level. Those are my words, not his. And so my concern is that, as he's already acknowledged, his judgment in this arena is not up to what I would expect as a member of the general public, the standards that your profession would require. Because there were several times. I mean, just even in the journal entries, which he says, you know, he wasn't aware of the content. But again, I'm relying on the word of my ex-wife, who is a person who I'll be honest, I don't trust a single word she tells me anymore, in part because of this. But that he was well aware of the level of her attraction to him. Maybe not to the level, as she called it, she said it was an obsession. It turned into an obsession. But he was well aware that she was attracted to him and that she offered to perform sexual acts for him multiple times. And now what she told me was that he deflected and he said, that's not why we're here. That's not, you know, appropriate. Until he didn't. But even at that point, every person I've talked to who has had any kind of training in psychological services has said that that's the point at which the therapy needs to be terminated, including all my own therapists who I've discussed this, you know, at length with. So I'm not personally here looking for something to... I'm not looking for a particular outcome in this. I'm just very, very concerned. And I know the impact that this has now had on my family. I believe my ex-wife's mother is on the line as well, my ex-mother-in-law. And if you'd like to hear from her, I think she's willing to make a statement. This has impacted dozens of people, if not more. And with my own children, I know because I'm a child of divorce, someday they're going to have questions about what happened. Why did daddy leave mommy? And I'm their primary caregiver. She only sees them 6 days a month. And I've tried to do my best to protect them from this.
AC, could you wind up your comments, please?
Yes. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Your time is getting up.
The phone cut out? Okay. I'll summarize.
Okay.
The impact of this has been substantial on everybody involved. And I'm just very concerned that Dr. Padilla's judgment is questionable at best. I believe I question his honesty, considering, like I said, that he seems to have misplaced the text messages between him and my ex-wife, knowing full well there's going to be a sort of investigation into this. And so I just am hoping that this will be taken seriously and delved into seriously and all the evidence that I supplied. And I'll leave it at that. And I appreciate your time and efforts in this.
Okay, thank you. You said that your mother-in-law wanted to make some comments?
Yeah, I'm waiting to see if she's on the line. I sent her the information to call in.
Is there anyone else on the line?
I don't think so.
No, apparently she's not. Thank you. Mr. Akins, do you have any follow-up?
No, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. Got to find my script here. Got to say these things right. Anyways, here we go. Dr. Brunner, do you have any questions of AC?
Not at this time.
Wow.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
This time. Thank you.
The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. Dr. Brundage, would you please begin?
Thank you, Chairman Donaldson and committee member. I am extremely concerned about what I'm hearing today, even more so than when I reviewed the material. I believe that Dr. Padilla was way over his head in this case. I believe that the action that he has taken afterwards in creating a media forum and every collateral forum certainly may have brought him up to standard. But I have ongoing questions. I know that it's been alleged that there was a texting history, then now There's a Snapchat history and the email history. I have looked at the phone logs, although without the ability to know numbers and anything else, it's hard to figure out who's calling from when and how. I believe this case merits a full board review and would at this time make a motion that this case be forwarded to the full board for review, case number 18-34. And I think that it needs to be investigated at a lot of levels. I know there's still allegations that there's been sexual impropriety, and I'm not sure, but I would like that at least to be part of the Arizona Revised Statutes. The Arizona Revised Statutes, I feel, that have been violated, and I don't believe that boundaries can have gray areas sometimes and not. I think that Arizona Revised Statute 32-2061, one indicating F, sexual intimacies or sexual intercourse with a current client or patient or a supervisee on a former client within 2 years after cessation of treatment. G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with a psychologist's professional education, training, and experience. O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And DD, violating ethical standards. I am concerned about the texting. I am concerned about the emails. I am concerned about the lack of supervision. I'm concerned about the sloppy consent agreement that had the Board of Behavioral Health. I question the type of supervision that's been provided to this person, newly licensed, but without really an idea of the difficulties that he was moving forward. And at this point, I'm still hearing a lack of insight as to the difficulties that he has created. So that would be my recommendation at this time.
Okay, I would second that. Dr. Flowers, comment?
I share concerns as well. I'm not as convinced about their allegations of sexual impropriety, of doing the wrong things sexually, but I don't know that there's sufficient evidence to pursue that one, but the other ones are more consistent with what I see as well.
May I respond?
Dr. Brundage, did you wish to request the text messages?
Absolutely,
yes.
Ms. Jones. And may I comment to Dr. Flowers' comment?
Sure. Yes, please.
I am unclear too. That is not as pressing. However, I would like that listed at this time because I think that there are still allegations that this occurred. The doctor is adamant that it didn't occur, but there certainly was inappropriate boundaries that I believe have been crossed, and I don't know at what level, but I would like it. I would like it out there.
Okay, that sounds, like I said, I'm not firmly in favor of that. However, certainly there is an allegation, and we're not making findings. We're asking for further review by the full board, and I can agree with that.
This is Jean Galvin. I heard a couple of times during the meeting that the telephone bills that were provided weren't helpful and that you weren't able to tell who was calling who. Would you request of the doctor and his attorney to provide information about those bills and to kind of decipher them for the board?
That would be wonderful.
It would, because I too thought, well, I wonder who those people are. Maybe they were calling to get a pizza. We don't know. But if they're either the licensee or the client, that's a lot more relevant. And then if there's a way to figure out who called who, that's relevant as well. And if the text messages can be retrieved, that'd be great as well.
I mean, I'm seeing some calls at 9:30 at night for 90 minutes. I don't know who those calls are from. And again, I think that, to have that clarity would help me understand exactly the communication patterns that were going on.
Yes, the second, I agree with Dr. Brundage's list of statute violations. It'll give the full board an opportunity to search through the information and see if they can substantiate the accusation or the charge.
Mr. Donaldson, also in fairness to the licensee and his attorney, it will give them an opportunity to try and substantiate their position that there weren't violations and that information was conveyed in a direct fashion. And if they can provide the text, then we can understand more what was text back and forth between the licensee and the client.
And this is Jean again. The Verizon bills, it may be more appropriate for the complainant to decipher for us, because these are his calls. I'm assuming that his ex-wife were on there. So if the complainant, if you're still on the line.
AC, are you?
I am.
Could you provide information to the board staff deciphering the telephone bills that you provided, highlighting which calls
I
you
can.
Received?
Let me.
Just highlighting.
Yeah, let me ask. I thought I already had highlighted all the calls. And so I just wanted to clarify if that information was lost when I emailed it over, because the way I had initially done it was I highlighted Dr. Padilla's personal cell phone number, and then I even had comments in the digital form of the PDF saying this is the first call, this is the second call, the third call, so on and so forth.
It's not showing up that way on my record.
Nor mine.
Krishna?
Okay, I can resend them if you can provide me with another email address, because I tried to contact Heather, and I guess she's no longer with the board.
Right. Krishna Poe from our office will contact you.
Okay.
Yeah, the more clarity you can provide, the better off it is. Any further comments? Dr. Flowers, Dr. Brundage?
None at this
Not
time.
At this time.
Okay. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed by the same sign, motion carries. So complaint number 18-34 is referred to the full board.
So may I just clarify with board members and board staff what it is that you would like from Dr. Padilla and myself?
Sure. Yes.
I'm asking.
Yes.
What would you like from us?
Dr. Brundage?
Mr. Aiken, I would prefer to have a complete list of emails. If and I know that you've provided some, but I don't know. I also know that the doctor had indicated that he didn't feel that after the therapeutic relationship had been terminated, he didn't perceive that ongoing contact was therapeutic. I disagree, so I would like to have a full cadre of email reports. I would also like full text reports in its entirety of anything that he conveyed to the client or about the client. I also am interested, I understand that Snapchat evaporates into the ether, but obviously I'd also like to get a clear understanding of why he would use Snapchat as a form of communications rather than continue email. But that can be provided to the full board.
And Dr. Brundage, if it would be acceptable, I know that Dr. Padilla would also like to provide his thoughts on, and I think you brought this up, his thoughts on the differences or issues of border crossings as opposed to border boundary violations. Would that okay?
Absolutely. I would welcome any kind of input. I just am having a really difficult time trying to figure this one out. And again, he said, she said, and all of those factors, I think that I just need to have an understanding of Dr. Padilla's approach and how he perceived that he was being therapeutic in his actions.
Very good.
And then... Thank you very much.
Yes, additionally, I think the client records, I don't believe we have them.
As far as I know, we've completed a full set that was submitted as part of the response. Are you finding that?
Did we receive all the client records?
There are treatment plans, there are progress notes, a progress note summary.
Okay, because if you're giving a treatment for half a year or so, I've forgotten the exact time. I didn't really see all that I thought would be there. If you can, you know, if
you should have every progress note in every session, which should be there.
Okay, well, I'll take another look, but if you can also ensure that we have that, because that's very essential as well.
We'd certainly be happy to provide a further copy, although I don't believe that it will be anything different than what's been submitted, but we're happy to do that.
I guess if you get a hold of a board staff and you could compare notes, you might literally make sure we have whatever you did.
All right.
If it's already there, there's no need to send it again. But I don't recall a sequential note, time after time.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we do have the progress notes from November of 16 to July of 17, and then a separate entry for July of 17 through April of 18.
Okay, does that match up? I guess you can take a look and make sure.
I'll be glad to call board staff, and we'll make sure we're all...
Okay, but if they have it, there's no need to send them another PDF with the same thing.
It would appear to be helpful to the board to review everything you've submitted and provide more clarity where you think that clarity is important. I would better explain. It's pretty complicated. It's pretty intertwined. And so the clarity you can make would certainly help the board.
And it didn't really, again, maybe it's in there. I don't recall seeing like a termination letter, or not letter, termination summary, or this is our last session, here's what you need to do kind of thing.
Dr. Brundage, any further comment?
No, not at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Very good, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you want to proceed on now with
yes.
Dr. Hill?
Dr. Hill.
Okay. May I have just a minute to step outside, and I'll come right back.
Sure.
I'll call her while I'm outside.
We'll have a short recess.
Okay.
Be sure you come back.
I will. I promise.
All right, Joe. Have we not provided?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Brundage.
I'm just wondering, at this point, it seems that we've provided adequate time, and I would like to move forward.
She's going to call in?
She's calling right this minute.
Okay, she's calling right in. Dr. Hill is calling in right now. Depends on that, how the connection is between here and Tucson.
Not bad.
And she had the numbers? There she is.
Sounds promising.
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Hill?
Hello. Yes.
Okay.
I'm so sorry about this morning. I mean, it's not that I don't take this really seriously, but I have a critically ill child who has relapsed after a bone marrow transplant 3 months ago, and I'm pretty sick. And chemo is going up this morning. I'm really sorry. Anyway, I'm here.
Okay, so...
Hello?
Yes, we're resuming.
Yes, thank you.
We'll resume case number 18-35. And Dr. Brunnett, did you have some questions for Dr. Hill?
I did, and thank you very much, Dr. Hill. I'm aware that there are issues going on in your life. The question
Go ahead.
The question I had wanted to ask is, I know that the complainant is at the board meeting, and I understand that you did not feel comfortable to appear in person.
I can't come up there right now.
Oh,
I would have come, but I just can't come now.
Correct. From the best of your recollection, how many interactions did you have with the psychiatrist regarding this patient? And from just an overview, what was the general tenor of the meetings?
Well, I may have spoken with him several times. You know, just the whole thing is an enigma to me because Steve and I always had a good relationship. I may have spoken to him several times, a couple of times before the interaction that he has the complaint about. But about that specific issue, trying to get her just back on this Wellbutrin until she could get in to see the GP that she had made the appointment with. I remember one, and actually I haven't reviewed my notes that went out. I remember one, but there was no yelling. There was no yelling. I mean, I am an animated person, and the best I can piece together is, I remember at one point he said that he thought she was lying and manipulative. This may have been a second conversation we had, which I take umbrage about my patient, because it was his patient too, but about this patient being accused of that kind of thing. So I may have become particularly animated about that. Probably it's more so than
Dr. Hill, Dr. Hill, we're having a very hard time hearing you. It's very garbled.
Well, what? I don't have you on speakerphone. Can you hear me any better now?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Is this better?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Sorry, it's about my phone. Well, do you want me to back up?
Yes.
Is that what I was talking about?
Yes, please.
Okay. What I started out by saying was, I don't remember specifically, and I haven't reviewed the notes that Mr. Farron put together, but I only remember... And I had probably talked to Stephen a couple of times about this patient that we shared before the interaction that he took umbrage with, and that he said I yelled at him or whatever. I'd emailed him, but I certainly didn't repeatedly harass him about this, because he agreed to go ahead and write just long enough, the prescription for the Wellbutrin long enough for her to get in to see her GP and go on Wellbutrin. He had, like they call it, fired her because he felt like she was non-compliant or not coming to her appointments, which she vehemently denied to me. Anyway, the idea that I yelled at him, I mean, I am an animated person, but I don't yell at people at work. I mean, I was probably, really trying to convince him to do this. I mean, he always had the alternative to say, no, I absolutely am not going to write this medication. I mean, it's not like I could force him, but the idea that I was going to threaten him and harass him about this, it just makes no sense. Obviously, he felt that way. But I've never, I've been practicing for years. I practiced at Scottsdale Psychological there in Scottsdale for years with 9 other providers. I never had a reputation for somebody that went off or, certainly if I had been a sociopath, I wouldn't have lasted there for 9 years. But anyway, is this answering your question? I simply was floored that this complaint against me, because whereas there may have been a close interaction between us, I certainly wasn't harassing him or yelling at him or any of that. It just made no sense to me. We had a good relationship, and I did. I thought we cared a lot of people. So I don't know what else to say. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Dr. Brown, did you have any follow-up questions?
No, that was just all I was asking.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes, I just have a couple of questions, and I believe they're pretty simple. From what I gather, you were providing some kind of therapy or counseling to the patient?
Correct.
Okay, so that's why you're coordinating the referral for the patient in regards to medication needs. Is that right?
Right. She had tried to get back in to see him. This is my recollection. She had tried to get back in to see him, and before she could do it, I don't know, she traveled a lot, she, whatever. And he told her he wasn't going to be able to see her anymore. So she, in a session with me, said, can you ask Dr. Abel, or, why, can I just, get this carry over prescription so I can, don't have to quit taking this before I can see it. You know how hard it is? I don't know. I know it is hard up there, too. It's hard to get in to see even GPs down here. You have to make an appointment for, 3 months. And she needed to be on the medication. So she had asked me if I would talk to him, which was not an unusual thing. He and I talked about patients frequently that we shared. So that was the situation with that.
Okay, so basically you're just trying to coordinate continuation of a patient who had been established with him.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Continuity of care, in my mind.
Okay.
Mr. Aikens?
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Hello?
Dr. Brundage?
Yes?
Did you have a comment or...
I do have no comments at this time.
The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. Since I'm the lead member on this, I'll begin the discussion. On page 3 of 39, SA claims that when the incidents occurred between him and Dr. Hill, there was never any witnesses present. SA also states Dr. Hill continued to call and email him requesting that he see the patient and prescribe medications. On the information SA submitted as evidence of his statement on pages 21 through page 25, there are 3 emails offered, 2 of which are duplicates. In the 2 emails, one is essentially one line requesting an appointment for the patient, the second letting SA know that Dr. Hill was receiving from her appointments with the patient. I saw no text that could be considered intimidating. The telephone call on 11-3-2017 from the Contact One call center shows one call made on the same date relating to the email. As part of the material submitted concerning this case, I also saw on page 17 of 39 this submission by SA. EA was formerly licensed as a psychologist in Arizona. We had both worked for the healthcare company in the early 2000s. After the company closed, I referred patients to her. I stopped the referrals after I became uncomfortable with the care they received. Over the years, this fear has been confirmed. I withdrew from care of all patients shared or others refused to see her again. Without further comment, I found no evidence to substantiate the complaint by SA and move to dismiss this complaint number 1835.
I second the motion.
Further discussion? Dr. Brundage?
I feel that this is, again, a case of obvious bad feelings between colleagues. I understand that it became very uncomfortable to practice within the same setting. I do not see any violation of either rule or statutes. It's unfortunate that it could not have been addressed in a much less formal fashion, and I, too, feel there's no merit.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes, it appears there's a conflict between two colleagues, but I don't see anybody's mail exploding or phone exploding, as the saying goes these days. There is some discomfort, but there may be some social skills issues, but it doesn't appear to be a violation.
Thank you. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. Complaint number 18-35 is dismissed.
Very good.
Thank you.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I second.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brundage.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.